All right. Good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 10:15 and the date is Wednesday, December 6, 2017. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyert, Deputy Secretary of State on behalf of Wayne Williams, Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Sharon Eubanks, Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services. Prior to this, we held an executive session and had some discussions about litigation. And at this time, well, I didn't write down how I was going to say that motion, but at this time, I move that the board individually consider each appeal and ratify by a majority of the board whether or not we are going to participate in appeals at the Supreme Court going forward.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So that will clue everyone in on what we discussed. And so for those of you who are regulars here, you will see on our agenda at the as the meetings roll through the session, a ratification of which appeals we are going to participate in as a board, appeals that we don't participate in, those will be briefed by the proponents and opponents, and the board will not be taking a position. With that said, we have a large agenda today. There are two titles for each measure that we set here at the board. One is a statement, and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board to the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is being broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's websites, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the title board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow three steps. First, board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the board understands the proposal. Second, the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40, 106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. That is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the board determines it has jurisdiction and it's a constitutional change, the board will also consider under CRS 1410635 whether the measure only repeals in whole or in part a provision of the state constitution. Finally, if the board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we take all testimony first, then the board will discuss and vote after all testimony is completed. A decision is reached by two of three members of the board. Please take note we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with setting a title. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set titles or to the correctness of the titles and summaries themselves. Anyone who's dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. The first item on our agenda is 2017-2018, number 48, state legislative redistricting. If the proponents could come forward and identify themselves.
Good morning. My name is Ben Larson from Ireland, Stapleton, Pryor, and Pasco. I'm here today on behalf of Kathleen Curry and Tony Larson, the proponents of initiative number 48.
Right. And we are here on this matter on a remand from the Supreme Court to make a determination under 106.3.5 regarding whether this is a repeal or an addition to language in the Constitution. Council, did you want to be heard on that issue?
Sure. And before I do that, I just want to make clear for the record that Ms. Curry and Ms. Larson are here today. We're here today for the board to make a finding under CRS 140.106.3.5 regarding whether number 48 merely repeals the constitutional provision, which it does not. It does more than merely repeal a constitutional provision, is therefore subject to the 55% threshold.
And is there anybody signed up to speak on this measure? No. All right. Any questions from the board? Make a motion?
Sure. I move that the title board find that number 48 does not contain only a repeal of a constitutional provision for purposes of section 1-40-106-3.5.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. The statute requires that, or I think the order required that we let the Supreme Court know within 2 days. Okay. So, Steve, could you just follow up with the AG on that?
Yes. I'll check with the AG's office to make sure that we have contact information and we can send that over to the Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Next matter on the agenda is 2017-2018, number 70, severance taxes on oil and gas. If the proponents could come forward and identify yourself.
Andrew J. O'Connor.
Mary Henry.
All right, we are here on a motion for rehearing. That was filed by Mr. Dunn. I assume you received a copy of that?
I did.
Okay. Then let's have Mr. Dunn come forward and.
Good morning, members of the board. Jason Dunn on behalf of objector Jeff Wasden. So with apologies to the large crowd that's here, we have five separate objections to the measure that was approved at the last hearing. Briefly, just to provide you a roadmap, our concerns start with critical drafting errors that exist in the measure that fail to meet the statutory requirements for drafting ballot initiatives. Second, there are vagueness concerns that were raised by legislative counsel and legal services in their review and comment memo that have not been addressed and that create such vagueness concerns with the measure that we believe this board is not capable of setting an accurate title for the measure. Third, we have concerns about the single subject requirement and the measure containing at least two, if not three, separate and distinct subjects. Fourth, if we get to that point, we have concerns about the title and that it doesn't accurately describe the measure and contains catchphrases. And last, we have objections to the fiscal impact estimate and abstract that were provided for the measure. So I'll run through those in that order, and if you want to stop me after each category and discuss, well, I'm happy to. And if at any point you want to vote on any of the constitutional requirements before we get to title or abstract, I'm happy to sit down and at that point. So addressing the first issue regarding the drafting of the measure itself, the final version. So as you recall, this body has taken up a prior version of this measure with initiative number 20. Those are part of a string of measures that were submitted to Ledge Council. I think we're up to eight versions of this measure. This is, number 70 is the second one that's made it to the title board. And the primary reason, not to speak for the proponents, but the primary reason that the measure was repeatedly resubmitted was because there were time and again problems with the drafting and how the statutory requirements were met in terms of using all caps and strike through and what measure was new language and what was old. And it was very confusing in the measures. And so legislative counsel and legal services suggested revisions and the proponents resubmitted numerous times. Some of those were corrected, even most of those were corrected to the version you have now before you in initiative number 70. And what you will see is that the proponents did get it right in that they included all capitalization for new language and strike through for omitted language. But the most central piece of the measure, which is the doubling to tripling of the severance tax on oil and gas, which is the heart of the measure, does not show that that's changed in the measure. So if you look at the measure itself in section 2, the first change is to take the existing requirements, which are the graduated scale from 2% to 5%. That's in current law, and the only change to that section was to change it to make that applicable only through the beginning of 2019. The next section, 1C, is new language. But if you look at the graduated scale there, that's the meat of the measure. And that's where the rates are increased from 2% to 7%, or at the top end from 5% to 10%. And that's what drives the, I believe, $480 million first year fiscal estimate. And if you look, there's nothing that denotes that that's new language in law. And it's important that voters who are looking to either sign a petition or ultimately vote on this understand. And the problem here is exacerbated, particularly so, for two reasons. One is that they finally did get it right, that they have new language in all caps. And here there's nothing in all caps that shows the breakdown by revenue. So it creates voter confusion because the rest of the measure is done correctly. And second, you have identical language up above in the immediately previous section, or on the same page in their measure, that shows the same scale in the same lowercase font, because that's part of existing law. So they took existing law, didn't change it, but changed the numerical values, and it will create voter confusion, and people just simply won't be able to know that that's a change of law and not part of the other parts of the measure that are existing law. I can go on. There's no questions about that.
I have a preliminary question. What is your best authority for us being able to say that we lack jurisdiction on this basis because of a problem in capitalization or indication of what
right.
is new?
I don't have the statute in front of me, but the statute itself is the answer. I mean, the statute says that the proponents shall highlight in the measure, I believe the word is highlight, in the measure the changes to existing law. And we had a discussion. I know you weren't on the panel, the original meeting of this measure, but there was a lot of discussion about, well, what does highlight mean? Does that mean physically highlight? I think we went through that on number 20. Physically highlight, does it mean underlining? What does that actually mean? And the convention, of course, has been to use all caps and strike through. The proponents here didn't or weren't able to do that in some of their previous iterations. But we could argue then about whether they properly highlighted something and whether that met the statutory requirement. There's no debate here that that change is not highlighted in any way. So the answer to your question is the statutory requirement.
And then just to make sure I understand your argument, is your concern that the words under and over are not in all caps? Would that?
Well, each of those lines, correct.
Sure.
Correct.
Okay.
I do have a question. In terms of the amending clause, it talks about adding 1C to that statutory provision, which 1C is the new language that imposes the increased rates of the severance tax. I mean, from a drafting perspective, there is another indication, as well as all of the other language in 1C being in all caps, other than the actual rates. I mean, so just because that one part, you don't think that people know that this is new law from those other indicators in terms of standard drafting practice? It's contained in a new provision of law.
So, correct. If you look back at the heading for the section, which voters probably don't read, and they would have to catch.
They may not read the text of the measure either.
That's true, unfortunately. I suppose you could say, look, that's a marker of something that's about to come in the measure that's different. But you know, the question is here: A, this is the heart of the measure. If any piece of this measure ought to be highlighted as new language, it's that. I understand if there were a word that was not in all caps in the middle of a paragraph somewhere, and I can understand the board's reluctance to send it back on that. But A, I would say this is the heart of the measure. And B, I would say that the board ought to take a, and we talked about this in number 20, my view is that the board ought to take a strict interpretation of that requirement. I think it is a slippery slope for the board that if you allow drafting errors that don't comply with the statute and start getting into gray areas of, well, is it substantial? Is it significant? How much does it really matter? Does it sort of indicate at the beginning of the section whether a change is coming and that's close enough? I think that's a slippery slope for the board, and particularly on one where it's the heart of the measure that you ought to apply that requirement strictly.
But isn't the requirement just to highlight? I mean,
It is, and I...
Slippery slope already. I mean, what does highlight mean?
Right, and we had that discussion, and as I said to Mr. Roper, I don't know if we need to get into today what it means to highlight. I would say it's not highlighted here by any way. I mean, the fact that it does say a new section was added doesn't meet the requirement that the change in law itself, the actual textual change, is not highlighted.
And again, you're not saying something should have been done differently with respect to the numbers in 1C, the 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%. It's just the words under and when it's repeated and then over.
Correct. I mean, I think you could make that argument. Some way you need to highlight that those numbers are new language.
But how would one do that?
That's a great question. You know, in the previous iterations of this, I believe, I'm not sure if it made it to title board, but certainly for Ledge Council, they have physically highlighted that or underlined. Those are options, I think.
Wasn't the discussion on number 20 more of a highlighting between the different versions in terms of the review and comment version, the amendments made between review and comment title and the final version? My recollection was the highlighting part is in terms of distinguishing the changes between the different versions. You don't have that situation here because there were no changes made between the review and comment version and the version filed with the title board. Isn't that correct?
It's true, right. There was no second, there was no review and comment hearing on this measure because of number 20. But in thinking back to number 20, the hearing on that here, I believe there was discussion and we raised concerns about both, that the changes between the original draft and the final were not highlighted, as well as the final version did not highlight the changes to law. Okay, moving on. So our second concern is really the concerns that were raised by Legislative Council and Legal Services, and this is Roman numeral 2 in our motion. About the vagueness of the measure itself. And I'll try to move through these somewhat quickly. Really four separate issues. In the review and comment memo for number 20, the staff asked whether the proponents intended for A, the state to retain all of the oil and gas severance tax revenue collected after January 1, 2018 as a voter-approved revenue change to the fiscal year spending limit in Tabor, or B, the state may retain the increased revenue as a voter-approved revenue change. I believe, and I'm not 100% certain on exactly what that distinction between those two is, but I believe what the staff was asking is, in his Tabor provision in the measure, where he attempts to exempt the revenue from Tabor, I believe, although I will say, as an aside, in his response to our motion to motion for rehearing, the proponents do actually say that Tabor is inapplicable here. So it's a little confusing that there is language in the measure about Tabor and it appears an attempt to de-Bruce, but then in his response to the motion for rehearing, it says Tabor is not applicable to this measure. But back to the point of vagueness. So the Tabor, and this also goes to our single subject argument. If you look at the measure, and this is section 3, that's essentially what I believed was the attempt at de-Brucing revenue from the increase in the increased tax rates. But it finishes with a clause that says, and without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district. And I believe what the staff was getting at there is saying, are you attempting to simply de-Bruce the severance taxes, or are you de-Brucing all revenue at the state level once this revenue from the severance tax comes in, as well as at the local levels? In other words, are you attempting a singular de-Bruce on the severance tax revenue, or are you de-Brucing those districts more broadly? And in response at the review and comment hearing, Mr. O'Connor said first, I like B better than A. But then after the staff suggested, well, it kind of reads like, don't you really mean to just de-Bruce the severance tax? He said, he changed his answer and agreed that it was probably A. I would contend, and that issue, again, there was no review and comment hearing on this one, but that concern has yet to be addressed. Again, particularly because he says in his response here, says Tabor is not even applicable in the first instance. So putting aside the issue of whether they can de-Bruce local jurisdictions with a statewide vote, it's not clear what they're actually attempting to de-Bruce here. I don't think the proponents know what they're debrucing here, or what they're attempting to debruce here. And I would contend that if proponents don't know that, Legislative Council and Legal Services don't know that, that this board can't know that, and you can't write an accurate title about an important provision of a measure to inform voters. And we would ask that you send it back on that for clarification.
But aren't you just essentially making an argument that this is subject to a constitutional challenge because Tabor doesn't allow you to do what you're doing here?
And, I think, don't we set questions all the time
that are subject to a constitution? I mean, that's not really for the purview of the board.
Right. The answer to that is no. I mean, I think that question really relates more to the single subject argument. I think about whether debrucing, whether debrucing local governments, putting aside whether they can constitutionally do that, sort of coiled up in the folds of the measure, violates a single subject requirement, particularly if that debrucing is not just with regard to severance taxes, but is actually more broadly debrucing those local governments in totality through this measure. And if the proponents don't know whether it's doing that, and that's hidden up in the folds of the measure, that clearly has to be a second subject. So to steal my own thunder, that's our single subject argument on that.
Yeah.
But to your point here, no. I mean, the question is you have to be able to write a title, even if it's a title that describes something that will likely be held unconstitutional in the future, if you don't know what the measure does. And I would argue that simply having the proponents come up now and say, well, here's what I wanted to say, here's what I meant, doesn't really help you, especially given their statements at review and comment hearing about whether you can truly, from the text alone, understand the measure and write an accurate title.
But where is there any real support for the notion that if an initiative doesn't make sense or if the proponent doesn't understand what they're doing, that that takes jurisdiction from the title board? I mean,
I think
back to the initiatives that had to do with the public trust of land, mm-hmm. or whatever those were years back. I don't think I ever understood in full what they would do. I couldn't predict the outcome. I'm not sure the proponents really understood what it was doing.
Right.
But the court still said, to the extent that something's vague, you just kind of do your best and set your title.
I think if you can make a reasonable interpretation of a measure, then that is your job. I don't think if you read the text and say, I simply do not understand what a major provision of this measure does, and therefore I'll just defer to whatever the proponents stand up at title board hearing says it does, and then put that in the title, fulfills your obligation. I think if you can't read it and understand what the measure does, you can't write a title.
Well, generally our practice has been to just follow the language, not necessarily what
right.
the proponent believes it does,
right.
but to just say, we don't understand what this is doing, so I'm just going to repeat the language in the question.
And here I don't think you can do that. I mean, I think if the debrucing of local every local government in the state, either with regard to severance taxes or even more broadly with regard to their entire budget, is in this measure, that's a significant piece of it and would have to be described in detail in the title. And so you have to be confident that your reading of the statutory language is accurately reflected in the title, especially when it's something that critical.
Haven't there been constitutional amendments that have debruced both at the state and the local level?
Not that I know of, but I could.
Amendment 23, the revenues could be spent by the state and by the school districts?
I'd have to go back and look at it to see if that truly debruced local government revenue. My view, again, it's not part of the purview of this body, but I don't believe the district under Tabor, being the state in this case, can debruce another district.
So for all these years, the Amendment 23 monies that school districts have been spending have not been outside their spending limits? That would be your argument?
Yeah, I mean, I'm beyond my expertise on how school finance works. But I believe, again, I'm guessing here, which is usually when I get myself in trouble, that Amendment 23 revenue comes into the state and is debruced at that point.
But in terms of the money then going from the state to the local school districts, that Amendment 23 monies were not subject to the school district's limits either. Without
right.
separate voter approval at the school district level.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look at whether or not the mechanism with which Amendment 23 produces revenue is different than how it's done here.
It's a state-collected income tax revenue that then gets distributed to school districts for education purposes.
Right.
And so I would argue that that can occur, and it has occurred, under constitutional provisions that voters have approved in the past.
See that. That's a good idea for a challenge.
Perhaps. Maybe some of the folks in the room will be interested in knowing that.
Again, I just don't know the mechanics of Amendment 23 well enough to know if it truly parallels what's going on here.
So I think we've moved a little bit into your number two under your Roman numeral two about the state versus local. Just if I could go back for just a moment to your number one. As I understand it, you're saying that because Section 3 of the new proposed measure, you're saying that we should deny jurisdiction because you think that language is too vague for us to determine the effect with respect to Tabor, and you support that by showing that the proponent, one of the proponents himself, was unclear as to the meaning of that language?
Generally, yes. I get nervous about the use of the word effect, because generally the title board does not consider the effects of a measure. But you have, you know, as you know, the case law says, the title board needs to understand the effect of a measure to the extent necessary to understand what the measure itself is intended to do and what it does. So if you read that and you say, I have no idea what that's doing, and you combine that with the review and comment memo where the lawyers over at the Capitol clearly did not understand what that provision was doing, it was clear that the proponents didn't understand what it was doing, I'm not sure what it's doing, then I would say you can't describe it in a title unless you are feel confident that you can interpret that in a way that no one else has been able to.
And this is the language saying the proceeds of this tax shall be collected and spent by the state as a voter-approved revenue change without regard to Tabor, essentially.
When combined with that last clause, it says, and without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district.
Okay. Thank you.
So I won't reiterate number two under our Roman numeral two with regard to whether or not it's intended to de-bruise local districts. And again, the proponent, he didn't even understand the question, let alone what was intended in the measure when we were in number 20. Moving to the third point, question 12 in the review and comment memo said, does the limit on the 125% of revenue in the perpetual base account apply beginning in the second fiscal year? And if so, what year is that fiscal year? And then when the proponents were asked about that, it was simply unclear about when that provision would kick in. I think it's important that you be able to write a title that describes when that provision will take place. And if the proponents don't know and the staff didn't know, then I would argue there's no way for you to know that as well. And similarly, on our last point, question 13 said, is there any circumstance that you intend the corpus of the perpetual base account to be used? The proponent responded to that by asking, what is the answer here? Again, indicating that he simply didn't understand the language of his own measure. So for those four reasons, we would ask that you return it to the proponents or to Legislative Council for perhaps better drafting and clarity in the measure so that you can accurately write a title. On the single subject, I don't know if I need to say anything more than that than we just discussed. Again, I would argue that the debrucing of local government revenue, whether it's on this narrow tax or whether it's more broadly, is at best coiled up in the folds of this measure. And I don't think voters at the local level who think about state revenue versus local revenue would know or understand or necessarily even agree, even if they did support the measure, that they wanted to debruce at the local level. And that would be a second unrelated subject, particularly if it debruces all revenue. I think that is all the jurisdictional issues we have. I'll pause there before I move on to title and abstract.
Yeah, let's y'all want to discuss that one separately?
Discuss the
single subject.
Do we want to let the
That's what I meant. All right, Mr. O'Connor, do you or your co-proponent have anything you want to offer in rebuttal? Or
yes, I do. I believe that you have my response in opposition, and it might be helpful if you read along as I hit some points on it. So this the single subject of this measure is the Colorado severance tax, and as I was on the way here this morning, I read a an email from my representative, Mike Foote, and I just want to put on the record that right now, Colorado's in the red on collecting severance tax. In fact, we have a $6.5 million shortfall. The first point I want to make is that Mr. Dunn's right about only one thing here, which is that we did meet with legislative counsel in order to get it right. I don't think 20 is relevant to 70 here. I think that's just a distraction. Mr. Dunn can cite any relevant case law to support his arguments, citing statute, and that's not adequate. I mean, we're not really here to argue about highlighting, are we? I don't believe that highlighting is germane to voters or how they view it. Going back to debrucing, that was never brought up by staff. The only person to bring that up is Mr. Dunn. I believe that there is a reasonable interpretation of this measure and that title should be set. If you go to Roman numeral 1 on my response in opposition to motion for rehearing, The title summary and the submission clause absolutely reflect the intent of this initiative. I repeatedly cite Brownlow versus Wunsch and Say versus Baker. I believe Mr. Dunn is really arguing the merits and the constitutionality of this measure, and I just don't see that as the purview of the title board. Roman numeral 2, the proposed measure is absolutely not vague. It's definite, clear, and understandable. The title board and the Supreme Court have held that an initiative challenged under this section, which is 140.107, even if the language is identical to the language of a previous initiative, which he's arguing in number 20, title should be set, and that's in regard to ballot title 2005-26, number 55, 138 Pacific 3rd, 273 Colorado 2006. We went by the suggested edits of legislative counsel, and we got it right this time. In fact, the waiver letter states that there were not any additional comments and another review and comment hearing was not necessary. Legislative counsel staff believes that that this measure is adequate and that title should be set. Roman numeral 3.
That's true, Mr. O'Connor. But I mean, the fact that they waive further review and comment does not mean that they believe title should be set. It just means that whatever you have submitted is similar enough to your last submission.
I agree, but I do believe it means that they had no further questions about the language.
Yes.
That's what I believe that that waiver letter meant.
Right. Nothing new that they hadn't
already
raised.
Okay, so it's my opinion that because there were no further questions on the language, that this title is adequate and should be set. Let me restate that for the record. Number three, the motion for rehearing should be denied because proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 70 complies with the single subject requirement pursuant to section 141065. And I cite two cases, matter of ballot title 1997-98 number 74, Colorado 1998 case, and regard to ballot title 1999-2000 number 255, a Colorado 2000 case. The proposed initiative is to raise severance taxes on hydraulic fracking operations in Colorado, nothing more, nothing less. Finally, on Roman numeral 4 of my memo, the motion for rehearing should be denied because the title is not misleading, nor does it contain any impermissible catchphrases. And I cite, in regard to proposed initiative on education tax refund, a Colorado 1991 case, as well as a matter of title, ballot title, and severance on clause, Colorado 1994. So I'm clear, and there's no confusion that I have on what the purpose and intent of the statute is, and I don't believe that there's any confusion on the part of voters that would read this. And I believe that title should be set. Do you have any questions?
I do have one question. In terms of the provision that's in Section 3 of your measure, I'd like for you to explain to me what you think that provision does.
I need to walk over and actually.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, you said Section 3?
Section 3 of your measure.
What wording exactly were you asking me about?
Just in terms of that provision, I'm interested in knowing your explanation of what that provision does.
Okay. Are you talking about revenue limits, subsection 8?
No, I'm talking about this. What's in Section 3 of your measure that adds 3929105, subsection 3 to that provision that talks about the proceeds of this tax received in accordance with the provisions of subsection 1C, and it goes on about being collected and spent by the state as a voter-approved revenue change. And without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district.
I'm not seeing it. I just want to be sure. Can I approach?
Sure.
Can you show me exactly what we're talking about on my copy, please?
This is not the same measure. That's
in the packet for initiative number 70.
Right. This is your measure? Right. Okay. So it's this provision right here.
Right here?
Yes.
Okay, I think I understand. We went through numerous meetings with legislative council to discuss this measure, this particular language. And the concern was that it would apply to either a retroactive year, retroactively, which they thought would be a mistake, and that it needed to apply to 2017-2018. That's what was discussed at Legislative Council, and that's why we made the suggested changes that they suggested that we make. Does that answer your question?
Well, in terms of this provision, in terms of, I'm interested in your explanation of what this provision does. I mean, it's relating to the new revenues that would be generated under the new severance tax rate structure that your measure would affect. So I'd like for you to understand what you believe that provision does in terms of the revenues that are collected under your new taxing scheme.
It doesn't, what it does is it prevents, if we don't hit a certain, if we don't collect a certain amount of money, it prevents it being pulled from the general fund or transportation fund or other funds, and that's what it does. So it's a limiting language to make sure that it's the revenue is not pulled from other funds if we don't hit a limit. Does that make sense?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Any discussion on jurisdiction?
I'll address Roman numeral one of the motion for rehearing. This is the whether there needed to be something different done to highlight, and I think for especially for the reason Sharon pointed out, where it indicates that 1C is a new section, and I think it's pretty clear in the context that shows up there. I am not concerned about us lacking jurisdiction because there wasn't some other additional highlighting done.
And I agree with your analysis. I mean, especially in terms of giving deference to proponents in terms of the process, the fact that the rest of the provision is in all caps, you've got the amending clause. I think that the fact that a few words aren't in capital letters isn't a defect that denies us jurisdiction.
I agree. I'll start out on the second regarding single subject. I think it is a little bit vague and confusing. I'll admit that, especially that final phrase that Sharon asked the question about. And I think that our response to things like that has typically been to just track the language, which I think I'd be willing to do when we get into the setting of the question. But I don't think that it is creating two subjects or that we are prohibited from setting title because of that vagueness. And I don't think that these other issues are creating a second title, and his confusion over the measure, the proponents, is not really something that I would consider in determining whether or not we can set a title.
In terms of the single subject issue, and in terms of Mr. Dunn's arguments under Roman 2, I don't think the fact that the proponent may not understand all the implications of his measure in review and comment necessarily makes the measure itself vague, and that we can't set a title on it. But I am a little concerned about the argument that he makes in his Roman 3, Mr. Dunn makes in his Roman 3 of his motion for rehearing. And while I agree that usually we would just track the language of the measure, What bothers me is that if you include that language, or even if you don't include it, the fact of the matter is that although Mr. Dunn and I may disagree as to whether local districts can be debruced through a constitutional an initiative measure, that the fact that it's referring to other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district, I mean, this debrucing for a local government may be done differently than in other existing constitutional provisions. But I find it troublesome that you have the what I would describe as your general debrucing language for the state about revenues collected and spent in terms of the specific severance tax changes that would occur in this measure. But then it says, and without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district. And that's because it says other revenue. And the fact is that if this truly does in some manner apply to other revenue, not just the severance tax revenues that are generated from the measure, then in terms of being a broader debrucing that in terms of single subject, then I don't think there is a single subject because it goes beyond just a severance tax rate increase. And that's what I find troublesome is because of that language. I mean, just adding it in, I'm not sure in my mind cures the problem because then I think you have a single subject issue that it's dealing with revenues other than the severance tax revenues generated by the measure.
And do you feel, I guess I'll just ask, do you feel confident enough that that is what that language does? Because, I mean, I agree with you if that is what that language does. If you take that language in isolation and it really is an entire debrucing for the state and every other local entity, and it's just folded into a measure, then it would be surreptitious and it would be a second subject.
The language, I mean, and I've probably seen a lot of debrucing provisions in both initiatives and things that are currently in the Constitution. And I don't know that they were generally drafted in quite the same way. And it's the other revenue because, I mean, if it was talking about this revenue, then being able to be collected and spent by any district so that local governments that receive a portion of this severance tax revenue, then they could spend that revenue without concern for their TABOR limits. But that's not what this language says, and I'm not quite sure what it means. And that's where my concern comes from, in terms of that it is something broader than just the scope of the severance tax revenues that would be generated under the measure.
Yeah, and I think the grammar here, you know, is part of the confusion because it seems to read that the proceeds of this new severance tax or this revised severance tax shall be collected and spent without limiting the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent. And I guess I don't necessarily read that as saying, I guess I don't know how to read that. Does it just mean that the new revenue would not cause a TABOR issue when added together with the other revenue?
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
See, and that's where my confusion lies in terms of, I mean, even if this was, and perhaps the way you're reading it may be okay, but then, I mean, it hasn't actually de-Bruced any revenues that are going to a local district? Because you've got your de-Brucing language that's very specific about being collected and spent by the state as a voter-approved revenue change. But that alone is not sufficient to, in my mind, to take it out of a local district's spending limit under Tabor. And so either that language in the last phrase is trying to do that, but it's also doing something else to the state, like I say, it is confusing the way it's written, and I'm not sure. And I'm afraid that if you take Mr. Dunn's argument that you do have a broader de-Brucing potentially, that one has to be noted in the title, but two then probably violates single subject. Because if it hasn't de-Bruced the revenue for a district, then the last phrase, I'm not sure what the reference to any district is intended to mean or affect, because right now I don't read it as de-Brucing those revenues at the local government level. No. Unless you take it's that last phrase, and I'm not sure that's sufficient to do that. But then trying to figure out what that phrase means, I have to admit that I'm not sure. But that's just my confusion.
I think I share the confusion about that, what that phrase is going to mean.
I mean, I don't think the proponent believes that's what it means. I'm not sure it's an argument over the intent. I think it's an argument over the effect.
Well, unfortunately, and I appreciate the proponent's explanation, but his explanation of that provision did not satisfy me in terms of understanding what at least potentially that provision may affect.
Well, I don't think we're getting any further enlightenment. So,
okay.
I think
where I think that leaves me is that there's a potential single subject concern, but that it's not clear that there's a single subject concern, and. Where does that leave us on jurisdiction?
And obviously, I did not sit on the title board when this measure was originally heard, this number 70. I did listen to the audio, so I'm up to speed on that. But at this point, because of my concern, I'm not comfortable. I believe the motion for rehearing should be granted in terms of there's a jurisdictional issue on single subject grounds, because reading that provision, that language, and I haven't gotten an explanation that helps me better understand that language. At this point, my confusion makes me believe that the measure may contain a single subject and that the title board should not have set a title for it.
And I'm in the same situation where I did not sit on the initial hearing, but I did listen to the recording and I also listened to the discussion with the legislative council about Initiative 20, which I don't think that resolve the confusion about this Section 3 to the extent that it's the same as in Initiative 20, and I haven't compared those. But there's at least, I think, a similar issue about confusion. So I think I would agree with Sharon as to sufficient concern about single subject and our jurisdiction, where I think we should grant the motion for rehearing.
At least on that ground.
Yeah, yes. Okay. And in fact, only on that ground.
And I mean, I was on the initial board, and I guess I disagree, not necessarily because of this initiative, but because generally I think that if we cannot truly determine the effect, that we should just track the language, and I don't think we know for certain whether it's really containing a second subject. And so I think, I mean, my viewpoint has always kind of been tie goes to the access to the ballot. So I'm just going to kind of stick with that general philosophy that, I mean, that would be an issue for the court to work out. If the court wanted to say, yes, that is definitively a second subject, I just don't quite know what to do with it except to say that if I don't know and I can't say with any certainty that I'm probably going to favor access over not setting title. So that's why, not because I necessarily disagree with the uncertainty, but just because I.
Okay. Well, then I would move that we grant the motion for rehearing on number 70 on the grounds that the measure contains or violates the single subject requirement.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And I'm opposed, so that passes 2-1. The motion for rehearing is granted. And we don't need to address the rest of the motion because it was only granted on those on grounds of single subject. And that takes us to the next item on the agenda, which is 2017-2018 state income tax. If the proponents could please come forward and identify yourselves.
I'm Marty Nielsen, co-proponent.
And I'm Mike Spaulding, co-proponent.
And I believe you all have filed a motion for rehearing?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to add anything to your motion?
Not particularly. I do want to state that we feel that the title board did a great job of setting the title initially. And it really has come a long ways from the staff draft, and we appreciate the effort that went into that, especially by one person who's actually not here. But we, on looking at it, see that there is room for more improvement, and you know, now that we have a clear copy to look at, we see a couple more changes that we can make, and this will be really effective for voters as far as making a decision on the initiative.
And is there anybody else who's here who wishes to speak on this initiative? Anyone? All right. Any questions from the board?
I do have one question. And I was not, again, I did not sit on the title board when the title was initially set, but I have listened to the audio recording of that meeting. And I just want to make sure that I understand in terms of the tax credit that would be allowed under your measure, that all other tax credits that are currently allowed in 2018 would be eliminated by your measure. Is that correct?
It's more like they're lumped in with the calculation of the tax credit that goes to everybody. So they're added into the other items, the five components that make it up.
In terms of the amount, in terms of calculating the amount of the tax credit that's allowed, but in terms of it's not possible for anyone to claim a income tax credit for expenses relating to restoration of a historic property or childcare or any other income tax credit that currently exists.
Right. And the majority of those credits go to 13 different corporations. There are some small ones that go to other individuals, but when you add up what they'll be getting back with the combined tax credit, everybody comes out ahead.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking is I'm just wondering whether or not the title should really say that it's eliminating all other income tax credits, because it doesn't really get that concept across. It talks about the one credit, but it just doesn't really explain to voters that all other tax credits are eliminated.
Yeah, it does mention the calculation, the sum of all tax credits in 2018.
In terms of the amount that's
right.
allowed, that's
right.
claimed, then that's used as part of the calculation for the credit. But the reason it's limited to 2018 is because there would be no tax
right.
credits after 2018,
correct? Right.
Other than this one that your measure would establish.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that, those 2018 total income tax credit levels, that would just stay fixed, you know, that number for all successive years.
Right. It's just a number for calculation.
Right.
Thank you for clarifying that. The only question I have.
Okay. Any questions?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
All right. So we have the, you all have obviously submitted your own question. And we have the one up on the board, and then I think Sharon's potential change, too. So if you guys want to
sure.
start us off.
Sure. In terms of the argument that the proponents raised in the motion for rehearing about the statement of the single subject, I agree that I don't believe we should include the language about a reduction in state revenue resulting from the modification, because that is an effect. I mean, looking at the measure on its face, I wouldn't necessarily know what the revenue impact is without looking at the fiscal impact statement. And so I believe that the statement of the single subject should be modification of the state income tax system. And remove that language.
I have that same reaction.
And so I would move that change on lines 1 and 2.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And then I don't know, and perhaps there can be insight from at least Suzanne, where it talks about reducing the rate over a 12-year period and allowing the credit, why it wasn't just a semicolon and eliminating the and, so that it's reducing the state income tax rate, allowing. It seemed a little strange to,
yeah.
to have a combination statement. And then in terms of the issue that I asked my question about, while I do think it's accurate about the description about the income tax credit, and I disagree with the proponents in terms of I think it's important for voters to understand the calculation of the credit in terms of those types of details
right.
rather than just saying that there's an income tax credit allowed. I think it may be important to, you know, whether it's, you say, repealing all state income tax credits allowed in 2018 with one credit, one income tax credit allowed to each adult full-year resident taxpayer. Because in terms of this concept, for people to understand, because obviously for corporations there would be no
No change.
No income tax credits allowed at all because they're not a resident taxpayer, correct?
Correct.
Right. And then also in terms of for individuals, whether they're part-time resident or a resident taxpayer who currently claims various credits, to understand that those credits would no longer be allowed, that it's only this one credit, and whether that kind of concept could be worked into the language, I think would be helpful in voters understanding the impact of this measure in terms of how it's changing the income tax system. And so you want to, so whether you say repealing all state income tax credits allowed in the 2018 tax year with one income tax credit allowed two, and then you'd strike the word allowing.
Just replace it with that.
And then I think you'd also take out the language to claim a state income tax credit. Whether you have any improvements. I know it adds some language, and I know the proponents were looking to actually reduce the language, but I think that's an important concept as a result of the measure that, I mean, it's similar to the measure we were just dealing with, that it in that title we referenced the fact that the credit based on property taxes, a credit against the severance tax was eliminated, even though that was just because the new tax scheme was in 1C instead of 1B. And so I think this is similar in terms of this measure by setting forth this is the new way that income tax would be calculated in Colorado, that they understand that that eliminates all the other credits and there's just this one credit.
I was wondering if there's a way to do it in a separate phrase, offset by semicolons, instead of trying to combine the repeal together with the description of the credit allowed.
And I think that would be fine, too, if you want it rather than doing it all in one, if you want to take a stab, be my guest.
I mean, what about their language just allows equal tax credits to all adult resident taxpayers? Not enough detail.
I'm not sure that captures the elimination aspect of other income tax credits.
But we are changing to a system where it's an equal tax credit. So, I mean, obviously you don't have individual tax credits if everybody has an equal tax credit.
Although they're entitled to an equal tax credit, they don't necessarily, if they choose not to claim it, then...
I mean, it is a line item of the four lines to take it. Admittedly, they could, you know, always donate...
It does say allows in their language.
Well, whether or not you could just take the language that appears on line three to say repealing all state income tax credits allowed in the 2018 tax year, and then do a semicolon, and then sort of go back, I think, to the language about allowing each adult full year resident taxpayer. And then you'd restore the language on line 4, too.
Do the proponents have any concerns with that language?
For that part, yeah, that covers it, if we want to add that in.
Over 12 years, not a 12-year period.
I know, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would we need to indicate that that would, I'm worried that that language makes it sound like it's just in the 2018 tax year.
All right.
Maybe current state income tax credits?
Repealing all current state income tax credits?
You know, the detail of how that's calculated is probably not significant.
I'm fine with that. So I would move the language on line 3 as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And then I think the only other change that I'd like to discuss that was raised by proponents, although in a different way, because they'd like to get the in connection therewith phrase eliminated and I don't know that I'm willing to do that,
okay.
But I do think that in terms of the statement of the single subject saying modification of the state income tax system, and then down in the last phrase of the title where we talk about modifying procedures, whether or not that's somewhat duplicative and perhaps another word could be used on line 8, perhaps something like altering or changing procedures. Just so that there, you know, there's a little variety there.
And maybe we could make it changing tax procedures and not have to detail collection, enforcement, administration. I mean, that's all part of tax procedures.
I got your point with that. I see some value in highlighting those three different aspects of income tax procedure because they are. They are separate, and I think it could be helpful to highlight to the voters that each of those are affected rather than just procedures generally being affected. That was my reaction.
Yeah.
And I agree that I think that's an important distinction in terms of the different types of procedures that would be affected by the measure. It falls into those three different categories, and I think it's important to specify them.
Okay. And then a trivial one might be over a 12-year period, just over 12 years. That's line 3.
The only concern I had about that was the timing under the measure that it only happens every year that there's a general election.
Right, every even year.
And so if this measure was approved at the 2018 general election, then the next change would occur in terms of the rate would occur in 2020. And so it's not just 12 years from the time the measures passed. It's over a 12-year period, but it actually doesn't start until, it doesn't first occur until 2020. And maybe that's a distinction without a difference. I don't know. But to say 12 years, it makes it sound like it's the following 12 years, and that's not quite, it's actually, I guess, 14 years. I mean,
depending when it starts, it'd be 6 periods, so.
Yeah, I mean, when you start 2020 and then
right.
every general election
that'd be 20,
year, yeah, but.
24, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, I don't have a strong feeling about that.
Okay. Well, I would move the change on line 8.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. That's all I have.
I don't have anything else.
Want to add anything?
I did notice that the word state income tax is there 6 times in 9 lines, and I'm pretty sure that we know it's state income. I mean, that's what the whole thing is. Can we just say tax instead of state income tax every time?
Well, no, because we use all the, I mean, I don't know. We can't say all income tax credits. Then people will be really confused.
And excited.
Are you trying to be surreptitious?
I understand your concern about the term appearing, but I just think it's clearer by having the reference to the type of tax it is throughout the measure.
Yeah, I just think if we alter it, people are going to potentially think there's some significance to the alteration.
Oh, it's different for this, yeah.
Yeah.
Or that it applies to other taxes.
Right.
I mean.
Yeah.
That's true.
So.
Do we have anything else?
Okay. So I move that the board grant the motion for rehearing on number 62 to the extent that we've made changes to the title as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us. Does anyone need a break? Okay. That takes us to 2017-2018, number 67, state legislative redistricting. And if the proponents could come forward and let us know you're here.
Good morning. Ben Larson from Ireland Stapleton here on behalf of proponents Bill Hobbs and Kathleen Curry, proponents of 67, 68, and 69 who are here today.
And this is a motion for rehearing filed by Mr. Gruskin. And did you want to come on up and let us know if there's anything you want to highlight?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Gruskin on behalf of the objectors to the ballot title on initiative number 2017-2018, number 67, Robert DeRay and Katina Banks. The motion for rehearing alleges three single subject violations, two of which have been before the board before, and while I'm happy to go through that, given your agenda, I'll bet you'd be happier if I didn't and simply incorporated any comments relative to those arguments from the hearings on initiatives number 48 and 50. So with the board's permission, I will do that.
Thank you.
So that would bring me then, and the two arguments involved are that initiative 67 converts the Supreme Court to away from an appellate role, as is its want and as is understood by voters as well as policymakers, and secondly, that Initiative 67 violates Article 6 on the prohibition on other public offices to be held by judges, namely here, unlike Initiative 68, which uses retired judges, this one uses senior judges, provides for their compensation, and makes no limitation on their ability to sit on matters that may or may not involve parties or interests that have matters before the new redistricting commission. So, and I would just, for purposes of ease, ask that my comments on initiative number 67 be incorporated when the board addresses 68 and 69 again to hopefully streamline your process. So let me jump then, with the board's permission, to the third argument. And I have an admission here. The allegation is made in the response, which is not part of your packet, but the response from the proponents' counsel, that I have sought to misrepresent and confuse the board and the issues here. So I will make an admission that the issue raised in the third part of our motion for rehearing is one I just flat missed when we first talked about 48 and 50. When I read 48 and 50, maybe as you did, you saw that race and language groups were now designated as official communities of interest for redistricting purposes. And I thought, oh, how nice. Perhaps you thought the same. Because I didn't raise it in my motions for rehearing on 48 and 50, and you didn't raise it during those hearings as even an issue that was relevant to single subject or the titling of these measures, although you did include competitiveness, which, as we point out in our motion, is an issue that had already been embraced by the courts and therefore was probably fell in the less than critical arena. But nonetheless, the board included competitiveness, and other than refining that language, we didn't object. But if you take a look at your packet and go to the end, the memorandum done by staff, legislative staff, in the review and comment hearing, they missed it too. So we don't have to feel so bad. And I will represent to the board that the memoranda on initiatives 48 and 50 missed it too. So as lawyers, we talk about coiled in the folds and surreptitious measures about what voters will or won't understand. Rarely do we actually have to make a public admission that we are one of those voters who got snookered, because this is a major change, not just to redistricting. This is a major change to how representative government's going to go forward. And if we're going to approve racial communities of interest, which have never been approved, they're not in the Colorado Constitution for state legislative matters. They're not in the constitutional analysis for congressional redistricting. Then what we are doing is saying that it is okay to district by race because legislative concerns are a function of color of one's skin, or alternatively, the language that one speaks. That what you think is what you look like, or what you say, and how you say it, as opposed to what are issues that are relevant to the populace of a proposed or an existing district. And that is a fundamental change from where we have always been. More to the point, because I don't want the argument that this is a merits-based argument. This is a departure, a radical departure, from what has been approved by both the United States Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court in terms of how districts are drawn in order to provide for fair and effective representation of constituents. And that is relevant because if we are going to fundamentally change the nature of how representative government is structured to allow for and authorize the use of race as the proxy for positions, then we will change the nature of what representative government is. And that is not, as we point out in some of the citations from the United States Supreme Court, that is not a place the United States Supreme Court has ever gone. The proponents are correct that when invoking the analysis under the Voting Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause, the question becomes or has been whether or not there is a predominant use of race. Well, if there is the ability to use race as the sole community of interest for a district, that is the predominant use of race. And I would argue to you that this measure undermines racial protection in yet another way. And this, too, is something that has been missed in all of the previous analysis by legislative staff, by the title board, and by yours truly. But I think it is relevant to the extent that the suggestion is made that there is no major impact based on this language. And here's what it is. And with the board's permission, I have two handouts that I'd like to provide to Mr. Ward for purposes of the board's consideration right now. Protections that are invoked in the measure, and here I would turn the board to page 2 of the measure, talk about the criteria for districting, and they point to depending upon the measure, boundaries, they point to communities of interest. They point to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, quote, in particular, 52 U.S.C. section 10101. No one ever asks, what does section 10101 say in the review and comment hearings or in these hearings? So I am providing 52 U.S.C. 10101, which is not a provision out of the Voting Rights Act. You can take a look at the references in text on page 3 of the handout for 10101. This is a provision out of the Civil Rights Act of 1960, not out of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. What does this protect, 10101? This protects against race being used as a physical or functional barrier to the right to vote. You can't use literacy tests. You can't keep people out of polling places because of their race or their color or otherwise. So what the proponents have done is to have isolated communities of color as communities of interest, and then said your protections are that you get to vote on election day. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has been embraced for many decades by the Colorado Supreme Court and by the United States Supreme Court, is recodified as 52 U.S.C. 10301, which I have also provided to you. Cited as recently as May of this year by the United States Supreme Court in the decision of Cooper versus Harris, found at 137 Supreme Court 1455, where the court, speaking through Justice Kagan, noted two provisions of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 and Section 5, are involved in this case, citing Sections 10301 for Section 2 and 10304 for Section 5. Justice Kagan went on to say Section 2 prohibits any, quote, standard practice or procedure, end quote, that, quote, results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race, citing Section 10301A, which you will find on your second handout. She continued, we have construed that ban to extend to vote dilution. That is the standard, not 10101. So you have race identified as a community of interest, which will necessarily extend into the representative act of legislators, whether they're state legislators or members of Congress. And you have undermined the ability, whether the Voting Rights Act applies is not a function of what gets written here, but what the kind of protection, by using in particular, the kind of protection that has been isolated is the physical act of being able to vote, not the right to protect against vote dilution. Now, the proponents suggest, oh, this is all much ado about nothing, because the decision last year that took their initiative that combined redistricting and reapportionment, and also that isolated just reapportionment, and found them to violate single subject requirement, noted, quote, to the extent initiatives 132 and 133 modify criteria to be used in drawing legislative districts and several other things. Such changes to the legislative redistricting process constitute a single subject, but they don't point you to that key language that is found in their citation of that decision, to the extent initiatives 132 and 133. So remember, 132 and 133 didn't use this race-based communities of interest. The only thing 132 and 133 did was to take a pre-existing criteria and layer in what the Supreme Court had already noted, both in reapportionment and congressional redistricting, as a legitimate consideration, that being competitiveness, and added that onto the top. So this acknowledgement fortifies the point that I'm making here, as does the fact that when the court found 132 to violate the single subject requirement, it noted the difference between congressional and redistricting, and noted that the reason that it was finding there to be multiple subjects is that there were distinct processes derived from distinct sources of constitutional authority and governed by different standards. So the issue of standards wasn't somehow lumped into the process of redistricting as always and forevermore a single subject. The court simply noted that what they did last time didn't violate the single subject insofar as it used existing criteria and layered in something that the court had already acknowledged to be a legitimate criterion under existing law. And therefore, we ask that you find that this is at least two subjects and return it to the proponents if you have questions.
Any questions?
I have a couple of questions. So the existing language, I believe, includes ethnicity as a factor. What, in your view, comes by adding race when ethnicity is already included?
The response, I believe, Ms. Roper, is that ethnicity and race are not the same,
I understand,
same thing, and therefore they cover different interests and address different prior ways in which representational interests have been minimized, or to use the language of the United States Supreme Court in terms of this case law, there's been dilution of voting interests. I don't think there's ever been an ethnicity case that I'm aware of that hinged on whether or not you were from Lithuania or you were from Guatemala.
You've mentioned language group, but it seems like your argument has been focused just on race. Do you have a separate concern about language group, or is it just a concern about racial?
I do. I think the same concerns apply because, again, the very notion that we could have language group districts, so there would be individuals who were elected based on constituencies that had a single unifying language, as opposed to a single unifying interest or set of interests before the legislative body, suggests that everyone who speaks Spanish thinks exactly the same about every issue that comes before the legislature, and it's just not true. So I appreciate your question because you're right, I minimized, but didn't mean to minimize, except to streamline the process, the fact that language groups are every bit as problematic, and honestly, the courts have found that to be the case where, albeit typically it happens in more localized rather than a congressional district, council districts, legislative districts, but the courts have frowned upon language groups just as they frowned upon using language, just as they frowned upon using race as the criterion by which districts can be set.
But isn't that same argument then true of ethnicity? Aren't couldn't you say the same thing? You're just assuming everybody of the same ethnic background believes the same thing.
I think you raise a really good question. I'm not aware that Colorado has ever set districts based on ethnicity, and I'm not aware of any currently prevailing case law that has legitimized districting based on ethnicity. So that's absolutely correct. It happens to be, however, something that's currently in the law, and therefore, to the extent that the proponents argue that somehow 132 and 133 decided that the existing criteria are not problematic, it's possible. But I think that what you're talking about is what are the criteria that go too far, and we know based on the case law that race is certainly one, and language group, probably based upon a number of the circuit courts, is as well.
Final question I had is within that subsection 3, it talks about communities of interest and lists these various items, and they're connected by and. Does that mean that is it your understanding, does that mean that the redistricting commission in evaluating these needs to take them all into account, or can it pick and choose among the different factors and use that as the deciding factor for creating districting?
I think that the way redistricting has been done, at least in my experience, is that the courts pick and choose to determine which type of category applies to a proposed or to a district as drawn, rather than saying that all of them need to apply to each district.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. If I understand your argument correctly, I mean, in terms of the criteria based on race or language group, for your arguments that perhaps those are, that's because it's such a major change to the way redistricting has been done in the past, that that's a separate subject. Is part of your argument also in terms of referring to the earlier measures that the Supreme Court already has ruled on, that would your argument also be that any measure that added criteria that wasn't in those earlier measures would be a separate subject? I mean, just because they weren't included in what the court said was a single subject at that point in time in terms of those various components of those measures, whether or not, I mean, if it wasn't race, if it wasn't language group, it was something else, I don't know, color your hair, I don't know. But is that part of your argument also, is that the court said it was only this criteria and that any change to the criteria would constitute a separate subject?
I agree with half of your question/statement.
Okay.
Which is the court said, as to these criteria, it's a single subject as presented to us, to the extent that the 132 and 133 do this.
Okay.
I don't think that any, let's use water policy concerns, for instance,
okay,
that if that were a community of interest, which it could be, and it has been, I don't think that there's any sort of suspect class. There's no, it doesn't run so contrary to the accumulated case law and to the body of law, statutory and constitutional, that it would somehow strike voters as being a surreptitious measure. It doesn't strike me that a policy-related concern, if you had a different type of categorization that had absolutely nothing to do with representational unity, but was simply a way of lumping people together that the court had frowned on, or as in the instance of an equal protection claim, you know, required narrow tailoring for. In other words, you have to show, if you're going to use race under the United States Supreme Court decisions, you have to have solid evidence or good reason. Well, this will be used as that good reason, which is what the United States Supreme Court cites, in order to justify race-based districting, if the state of Colorado should adopt this. People ought to decide separately the mechanism, the process. And the proponents suggest that this really isn't a process, their measure, even though the quote that they use from the 132-133 decision talks about how all of these things are part of the state legislative redistricting process. When you lump this type of substantive change in with a myriad of procedural changes, one is intended to mask the other. And the one that nobody's caught is the one that got masked.
So if I understand from your response that it's the nature of these particular criteria that is such a substantial change that it constitutes a separate subject. And in the future, there could be other criteria that might fall in this category, but there might be other criteria that isn't such a substantial change that it wouldn't constitute a single separate subject.
I think you've summed it up better than I've stated it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the proponents.
Good morning. I think to start, I would like to incorporate my arguments with respect to the first two issues raised by movements with respect to initiatives 67, 68, and 69, just to save time. Is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So then I will move on to the third argument raised by movements, which relates to the inclusion of race and language groups in considering communities of interest. I would first just like to say that as an initial matter, I disagree with movement's argument about 132 and 133 with respect to whether we are simply, I think the argument was really that we were replacing existing criteria or doing something with the existing criteria. We were not doing that in 132 and 133. There were certainly new criteria that were being added. And the language from the court is very clear that to the extent we are modifying the criteria, that is certainly directly related to redistricting. And to the extent that movements also argue that we are simply making this a procedural measure is incorrect on many levels. And I want to clarify, do you all have our response in opposition? Okay. These measures do a laundry list of things that are above and beyond procedural, and we have never taken the position that this measure is simply procedural. And so, because I think on its face there is no question that modifying criteria fits within the single subject, I do believe that movements have taken a tactic to confuse the issue. And where I really take issue or offense is when movements contend that what we are doing by including race and language groups within multiple considerations and criteria for the one criteria, which is communities of interest, which, by the way, I believe 24 states consider communities of interest, including a laundry list of things. Many states, I know of states that use race and language group in considering communities of interest. When movements argue that, I think one of the phrases was race as a proxy is something that I heard. Nothing in our measure makes race a proxy for districting. Mr. Gruska knows, and I know, that the inclusion of race and language groups in the communities of interest is to protect those communities of interest. And to argue that somehow considering race is unconstitutional is flat wrong. It is unconstitutional to say race is the predominant factor in considering communities of interest. So, for example, if our measure said, we will redistrict based on race, that's it. That is absolutely inaccurate representation of what our measures do. There are several other factors to be considered just within the community of interest factor, along with things like compactness. So I think what I got and gleaned from some statements that are made with respect to racist proxy and the fact that are inferring that this is somehow going to allow us to redistrict based predominantly on race, those statements are wrong. Just as I think Mr. Roper was asking a question, well, of course, we've got ethnic groups in there, and ethnic groups exist in the existing law. Does that then mean that we can redistrict based solely on ethnic groups? No, it doesn't, because that's not what the measure says. And of course, all of this is overlaid by the fact that we have to comply with the Constitution, which is in the measure itself. And it would be unconstitutional to consider race as the sole factor for redistricting. So I think that I believe what movements are trying to do is to confuse the issue with respect to the purpose and the inclusion of the race, and language groups in protecting communities of interest. And as I said, it ultimately comes down to a merits argument. If movements believe that we should not, that we should ignore race and language groups in trying to preserve communities of interest, then they're free to argue that. And we disagree with that because we think it's important to consider those groups in preserving communities of interest and protecting their rights. But if they want to argue against that, they're free to do that. But that goes to the merits, and that's not pertinent to the title board's consideration.
Thank you. Any questions?
One question I did have. You heard Mr. Gruskin's reference to the particular U.S. Code section that you referenced not being part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Anything you want to say about that?
I would say that I think it would be accurate. My understanding is that that provision is typically considered part of the Voting Rights Act. I think it would be more accurate to include ETSEC after that citation. And I believe the board has authority to make technical changes to the measure, and we would be fine with adding ETSEC to make that a more accurate statement.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
What do you want to?
Just very briefly, Madam Chair.
Sure.
The board's authority to fix clerical errors doesn't extend to changing the substance of the measure. And that's exactly what you've been asked. You've been asked to fix what they've done five times. This is the fifth measure. It's the third of five measures before you. They presumably did it with knowledge and intent. And to the extent that they now say they didn't actually know the part of the statute that they were citing, A, that ought to give you pause, but B, the fact that it was never discussed in front of legislative staff would, I believe, deprive you from somehow changing their measure to expand coverage or specify coverage. It would make no sense to say in their measure covered by the Voting Rights Act of 1965, particularly the entire statute, which is what they're asking you to do by adding ETSEC. If they had an idea about the right they wanted covered, they should have been clear about it. And they were clear about it. They want you to fix their error or to add to their measure. That's not something I believe that you have the jurisdiction to do. As to the other comments made by Mr. Larson, I think I anticipated them and aren't going to take your time unless you want me to.
I do have one question. In terms of a statement that Mr. Larson made, in terms of the assertion that under the communities of interest criteria that race and language groups are currently considered, would you agree with that statement or not?
I'm actually not aware of any state that calls out racial groups for use as a matter of communities of interest. I'm not saying there's not some. Every state does it differently. For instance, the very first version of this measure back in November 2015 was one that was taken from Iowa that specifically said that racial groups could not be, voting strength could not be enhanced or diluted. So I believe that the proponents have looked at other states, and I'm not in a position to say what those states are or whether or not they in fact use this, but I am in a position to say the United States Supreme Court has never sanctioned the use of race as a community of interest. And the quotation from the LULAC case that we provide in our motion for rehearing says just the opposite. It's the non-racial groups that comprise communities of interest, not race.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm one of the designated representatives. I do want to respond to one narrow point. Mr. Gruskin has pointed out a drafting error, and as somebody who was involved in the drafting, I just want to make a record about that. The citation that he refers to, 52 United States Code, Section 10101, that should say ETSEC. And that's a drafting error that was not pointed out by legislative counsel. I was not aware of it. It's actually, there are other citations that are exactly like that, that do say 10101 et sec. And one example is section 1-7-1035B. That's the full citation. It's just simply a drafting error. I want to make a record of that. And I do think the board has the opportunity to correct that, even if the board decides not to do that. I just wanted to make the record that that should, the full citation would end with et sec.
What was that statutory reference?
1-7-1003, paren 5, paren B. I think there may be others, and I'll just add that citation, earlier versions had a different citation that is also found in the statutes, and a group that we consulted that has expertise in this area actually corrected our citation to be the new citation is 52 United States Code 10101 et sec. So I believe that would be the correct citation. It is found in that one section that I referenced, Mr. Roper. But I also think the old citation also appears in the statutes, but I don't have that handy. Clearly, it should be 101. The Voting Rights Act is not that one section, and proponents never intended to imply that the entire Voting Rights Act was simply section 10101. But we do intend to require compliance with the Voting Rights Act, which is the substance of that provision. Thank you.
I have a question for Mr. Hobbs. In terms of how that language reads, as I'm reading from your measure, it talks about the commission shall comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, comma, in particular 52 U.S. Code section 10101. So I don't view the in particular as the citation for the entire Voting Rights Act of 1965. I mean, it says shall comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act, and then it says in particular 10101. Am I reading that correctly or not?
I don't recall the use of why the drafting just says in particular, why that was called out. And that, you know, what I do know is that the intention was consistent with congressional redistricting, consistent with current law, for the reapportionment commission, there has to be compliance with the Voting Rights Act. I think the intent here was just simply to provide a citation to the Voting Rights Act. So I can't really speak to why it says, in particular, a citation. All I can say is it should be the full citation with the et sec.
Thank you.
All right. I think the motion for rehearing really is keyed in on the single subject, so that's the discussion before the board. We've dealt with, as Mr. Gruskin pointed out, the bulk of his motion at prior hearings, and the new part that he brought today was, I think, C. I don't view C as a major change, and to the extent that I suppose we did, I don't know that that would affect the single subject. I think we already redistrict according to communities of interest, and we consider ethnicity, and this might be a little bit different, but the fact of the matter is that we list by district in the redistricting ethnicity / race, and then we say how many people fall into that when we do redistricting on our current maps. So I just don't see it as a major shift. But again, even if it was, I think that that's an issue for the campaign and the voters. It doesn't change whether or not this is a single subject. So I'm
comfortable denying the motion for rehearing.
And I agree. I feel the same way with respect to Mr. Gruskin's A and B. I would deny those for the same reasons that we did in the earlier iterations. And then as to part C, whether or not there's some constitutional concern, I don't think that this rises to the level of a separate subject. So I would deny on that basis. As to the reference to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, I think the language plainly would require compliance with the entire act, regardless of this, the pointing out the in particular. And so there was some suggestion about possibly adding et sec. Whether or not we have authority to do that, I don't think it would be necessary here, because I think the language would require compliance with the act in its entirety, regardless of any particular citation there. So I would be opposed to adding anything to that section there.
And I'm in agreement with Mr. Roper's analysis. I mean, in terms of the first two arguments, we've dealt with those before. I'm not persuaded this time. I understand Mr. Grusin's argument. I think it makes it difficult, based on the nature of criteria, whether or not that would be a separate subject. And so at this point, I think that modifying the criteria used for redistricting is a single subject, and that I would deny the motion for rehearing on that ground also. In terms of the statutory citation, I agree. I think the language of the measure is clear that the commission would be required to comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, and we don't need to make a change to the text of the measure.
Okay. Then someone want to make a motion?
I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on number 67.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So that motion is denied, and that takes us to 2017-2018, number 68. And if the proponents could just start by...
68.
Which is state legislative redistricting.
So the arguments are the same. And I think, I believe Mr. Gruskin, we're on which measure now?
68.
I believe Mr. Gruskin asked to incorporate all of his arguments with respect to 68 and 69, and I did the same. So I believe that I have nothing more to say on either 68 or 69, or the arguments are the same.
But okay.
Mr. Gruskin's motion.
Yeah. On 68, can we just confirm both proponents are still present?
Yes. Both proponents are here, Bill Hobbs and Kathleen Curry.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Gruskin.
As indicated earlier, I will ask the board to incorporate the comments made in the hearings on 48, 50, and 67 for purposes of your consideration of 68. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the board?
No.
I'll incorporate my statements from before. You can go to, yeah.
And this, to the extent we need to make a record, this has just the two issues rather than three, but this has the converting Supreme Court from appellate to de novo, that argument, and then the argument about adding race and language group. And I would treat those the same way as in 67.
Okay.
I agree.
All right. Someone want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on number 68.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to 2017-2018, number 69, congressional redistricting. Go ahead, counsel.
Again, Ben Larson here. The proponents, Kathleen Curry and Bill Hobbs, are both here today. And I will again incorporate all of my previous arguments on 48 and 50 with respect to the same issue that was present there, and my arguments on number 67 with respect to the last issue related to race and language groups. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gruskin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nothing to add other than to formally incorporate on this record the earlier comments on 48, 50, 67, and 68. Thank you.
Thanks.
So this one is very similar to 68, makes the same two arguments about converting appellate review to a de novo trial on the merits, and then violating single subject through the inclusion of race and language group identification, and for the reasons that we've addressed before with the earlier measures today and then 48 and 50 earlier, I would deny the motion for rehearing.
And I agree.
I also agree and will incorporate the same. Do you want to make a motion?
Sure. So I move that the title board deny the motion for rehearing on number 69.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That is going to take us to number 66, but we have to switch out the board, and then I think we need to take a break anyway. Do you want to grab lunch, or what do you want to – or you want to just keep going, or
– whatever.
Can I suggest at this point we take a 45-minute lunch break and reconvene at 1 p.m.?
Okay. I'm fine with that.
All right.
Can do that. All right. We'll reconvene at 1. Yeah.